This is 16.9 The Podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 16.9 has been covering the digital signage industry for more than 12 years, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon and into what stuff means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. You can listen to episodes online, get them off iTunes or Google Play, or subscribe using a podcast app. Whatever way you choose, they're free and there's a new one weekly. The 16.9 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported from the start by Jeremy Gavin and his team at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at ScreenFeed.com. I'm kind of breaking my own podcast rule here by interviewing someone for a second time, but Burr Smith has been a busy guy lately, buying companies and fighting patent trolls. I spoke with the CEO and owner of BroadSign a couple of years ago, but it was more than time for an update chat given recent events. BroadSign acquired Iuta Media Systems, which at least some in the industry would see as a competitor. Then they bought another company in Montreal called Campsite, that's a programmatic ad exchange. This happened recently in the wake of a long, expensive, but ultimately successful legal battle with a Swedish company that would generally be referred to as a patent troll. While most companies took the path of least resistance and paid go-away money to these guys, Smith fought them. In this podcast, we get into the backstory of the recent acquisitions and then have a chat about Smith's going toe-to-toe with T-Rex. Burr, thank you for taking the time. I know you were just off a plane yesterday, or maybe it was this morning. We've done a podcast before, and I'm kind of breaking the rules here of going back to somebody I've already spoken to, but a lot has gone on recently, and I kind of wanted to dig into that.
It's a pleasure to be here, and always a pleasure to talk with you, Dave.
The big news, of course, is that recently, I forget how many weeks now, you bought Iuta, which for many years was your competitor and neighboring competitor.
Yeah, although it's oddly enough, the market perception is that they were a significant competitor in a lot of ways. There's been kind of a divergence in the market over the last several years, as far as we haven't really seen them in many competitive situations over the last 3 or 4 years. And what we really found when we looked at the company is that the product offerings are really pretty significantly complementary. So It's kind of exciting because we like the people and we like the products. There's a little bit of challenge relative to integrating the tech stacks, but it should enable us to do an entirely different job of what are our two main objectives, which is to service our clients and to outgrow the overall market.
Mm. My perception of the Iuta side of things is that company had the back office stuff that BroadSign didn't really offer. You were about booking and targeting and, you know, getting the content out there and running it properly, whereas Iuta handles all of those other admin things that BroadSign really didn't touch.
Yes, they have elements of that, and they also had a pretty good footprint, obviously, in the classic inventory side, which we're not as developed in. So all things considered, it's an exciting opportunity to blend the two.
So the idea, part of the strategy, I would imagine, with them having a big footprint in classic print billboard and poster inventory is it's at some point likely to cut over to digital, right?
Some of it will, some of it won't. You know, there will always be a classic component of inventory, but there's just as much need to increase the efficiency of how you service the classic segment of the market as there is the digital side of the market. And so that happens to be, you know, I mean, BroadSign is really all about trying to increase the efficiency and of being able to help our clients run their business in a profitable manner.
There seemed to be a degree of inevitability to some sort of a deal between the two companies. Is that fair?
Well, we talked, to be honest with you, Francois and I had our first conversation on the topic probably October and November following BroadSign exiting its Chapter 11, right? So we discussed it at the time and just couldn't. We've had, you know, 3 or 4 different conversations over the years. It just wasn't ever the right time. And it just got to the point in the evolution of the market where it made sense to have that happen. And the amazing thing is just how close the corporate cultures are. It's really, you know, the day we announced the deal, you know, normally you announce a deal like that and people get a little bit concerned and so forth. We had a Sanka set that day. We brought the guys from IUD over, and I'll tell you, we had them come over at 4 o'clock. By 5:30, you couldn't tell who was with IUD and who was with Broadsign. You know, the similarities between the people are so dramatic that it's exciting to kind of watch the two teams work together.
Except those guys are all wearing orange, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, we have to adjust our colors a little bit.
Was that a bit of an odd conversation to have with François, who de Gaspé Boisbien, who is the chair of AUDA and Montreal-based investor? Was it weird to have that conversation when you were just emerging from Chapter 11, and that would seem like not something that would be on the radar?
Well, I guess at that point in time, there was a perception where everybody felt that Broadsign was in a weaker position than it was, and I kind of had a unique point of view on that. Having cleaned up what we cleaned up, I felt that Broadsign was in a much stronger position than probably everybody else in the market. And so I had a lot of confidence in the company. And I like to think that events over the last several years have proven that my judgment was generally correct on that. So, you know, yeah, it was an odd conversation, but we were growing at the time and I felt we were going to get stronger, and just didn't make sense to do a transaction at that time.
And what's the state of Broadsign now with the two, or I guess three in certain respects, amalgamated companies in terms of size and everything?
So we're just under about 250 employees. Broadsign has, obviously you've noted it, has evolved a little bit from basically a single product company. Probably when I took over the CEO job in 2014, now we have obviously a platform of products. And basically, if you look at both of the acquisitions were basically product plays. They were things that we wanted to put onto our platform at some point in time. We weren't going to be able to recruit and build quickly enough to be able to achieve what we wanted to do for the market in the time that we felt it was important to do it. And so acquisitions just seemed to be the logical way to go. And fortunately, in these particular cases, we had companies that were available that had really attractive product offerings. So we're very excited because it's, you know, essentially it's Broadsign, but we've brought in, you know, new talent pools and so forth with new experiences. And we just feel that we'll be able to, as a combined company, the new Broadsign, as it were, be able to develop even more products for our clients. And I hope that answers the question.
Yep. How does it work in practical terms now? Will it be one big product, or will AUDA sit separately and be marketed separately?
Well, to be honest with you, that's, you know, we're still going through the process on that. You know, IUDA has a valuable brand name and a valuable client base. Just to restate, Broadsign's goal is to always achieve satisfaction for its clients, but also to be aware of the market. That being the case, there are IUDA clients out there deployed on the current software, and we're going to continue to support those IUDA clients on this software. The IUDA software base hasn't been invested in very heavily over the last couple of years, so there'll have to be new investments in order to upgrade the software. And that begins to get to be a little bit of a technical challenge on how we do that. But basically what we'll have to do is we'll have to evolve those products in a way so that we can bring as much as possible all of the products into a single platform as soon as possible. That'll take a little time.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine that there are clients who would like to take advantage of what that brings to them, but they don't want to have two logins.
Well, yeah, there's that. And you know, just the connection times between the interfaces. Right now, to be honest with you, we probably got three or four good sized deals where people are talking to us specifically to say, okay, how do I get both of the products at the same time? And we're trying to figure out ways to do that in a way that works effectively for our clients.
You're not just looking at them and saying, no problem.
No, obviously the worst thing that you can possibly do is promise somebody that you're going to do something for them and then fail to do it. That's a way to have an unhappy client. So what we try to do is we try to say, well, you know, this is the way we see it right now. This is where it's going to be. This is what we can do. And this is the evolution path we can provide for you. And we're more than happy to work with you in order to get to the place where you've got everything you want over a period of time.
Right. The deal did not include Hivestack, which is an IUTA spin-out company, but then you guys acquired Campsite, which at least to me, sitting on the sidelines, not directly involved in digital out-of-home day-to-day, seem very similar. How do you define and distinguish these? Are they very different companies and I'm just stupid? Well, I am stupid, but...
Campsite wasn't for sale as part of the transaction. If it had been, we would have discussed that.
Or Hivestack wasn't for sale.
Hivestack wasn't for sale. Yeah, I'm sorry. We do have a commercial integration agreement with Hivestack, and that's important to us because BroadSign very much wants to be an open platform. So that commercial integration with Hivestack was important to get done as part of the overall transaction on the IUTA transaction. Campsite is really, the reason for that acquisition is there are certain elements of the product map that they have that are very, very attractive to BroadSign and have been basically things that have been on our roadmap for the last 2 or 3 years. For one reason or another, we weren't able to acquire either the engineering talent or be able to develop enough of a workflow expertise in order to develop those products. And so when Campsite did become available, we absolutely just couldn't pass up the opportunity looking at the transaction. And we're really, really excited about that in a lot of ways because it gives us a lot of new product depth. There's been some concern that's been expressed by a couple of clients relative to us being in the demand side. You know, in a way, as a long-term issue, I'm not really terribly excited about being on the demand side because it adds confusion, primarily BroadSign services publishers. We're on the supply side. But there's elements of the demand side that are necessary right now, particularly the automated small transactions. There are certain elements of that product stack that are necessary in order to understand how to service the total market a little bit more effectively. Sometimes you have to have an offering within the full product stack so that you can understand what the individual customers need. And so we're really quite excited about the Campsite acquisition also. We don't have any intentions of going out and competing with some of our, you know, great DSPs like Outmove and the Trade Desk and some of those people. But at this juncture in time, it's probably a good time to have a little bit of capability in that area.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit screenfeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that, and then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
To a somewhat casual observer like me who doesn't spend every day immersed in digital out-of-home, this all seems kind of confusing. The demand side, the supply side, what BroadSign was doing, what it's now added in there. Is it more of a perception thing for me and the people who you deal with on a day-to-day basis, you and your folks deal with on a day-to-day basis, they get it?
Well, you know, to a certain degree, what's happening, particularly as far as programmatic trading and automation and all of that stuff, it is a confusing process, right? Anytime, you know, you appear at a conference somewhere, and somebody talks about programmatic, and invariably, there's probably 7 or 8 different definitions of what programmatic means to different people in different contexts. And that's because we're talking about a situation where the market is really kind of coming together and is being created right now. So there is a lot of confusion as to that. What we're trying to do is we're just trying to tell customers that BroadSign fundamentally is around in order to service our publishers and the people on the supply side. We're trying to build products that allow them to automate their processes, to open up new channels to demand, to open up new efficiencies relative to the publication process and so forth. And so that involves a pretty broad spectrum of new products that will be developed over time, and they'll move at different paces and so forth until we get to the place where the efficiency of the market and the magnitude of money flowing through the market increases pretty dramatically. And, you know, I don't know, short of trying to tell people this is the way we see it, and other people may have different opinions on it, but short of telling people this is the way we see it and this is what we intend to do, that's kind of the way we always try and pursue things. We say this is what we see and this is what we're trying to do.
Is it a case of the industry being too nascent and too hyper-competitive to enforce or develop and then enforce standards in terms of what you call things?
Amongst the publisher community, there are varying levels of sophistication. There are some publishers that are highly sophisticated relative to how to sell into a programmatic audience or how to sell into an audience segment. And there are some that are less sophisticated. So there's different levels of sophistication that occur there. And amongst the less sophisticated clients, there's probably just a lack of understanding. And at this juncture, I think there's even a perception that if you say programmatic, it means money comes falling from the sky, and it's not going to happen that way, you know? So there's still some of that that's going on. Amongst the more sophisticated publishers, there's still a concern about potentially seeing their yields be eroded. They're seeing their demand options being foreclosed and things like that. I think at the end of the day, we're going to have a couple of standardized sort of avenues to access the demand market. It probably won't disintermediate dramatically the existing flows that run between agencies and publishers. What'll happen there is we're simply increasing the efficiency of how those demand sources and supply sources are connected together. But then there's also going to be access to new demand sources and new pockets of advertising money too. And the best thing to do is to kind of limit options, I think, and come to the place where we're, you know, there's maybe 3 to 5 options that you're going to plug into. And then you're going to have a level of standardization that will enable people to focus more on those particular channels. I don't know whether I've used this analogy before, but as an investor, when I look back at things, it's if you look back at Microsoft's original MS-DOS operating system, or Microsoft Word, or even the web browsers as they developed, when you had multiple different vendors that were providing all of those solutions, there wasn't any concentration and there wasn't really any dramatic growth in the overall market. It's only when you began to get narrowed down to 1 or 2 or 3 providers that all of a sudden you got a hockey stick growth, because everybody understood this is kind of the standard that we work against. And that's when the real efficiency drives into the market. Does that make sense at all or not?
Yep. What was the feedback at the OAAA meetings, which were what, last week?
Oh, yeah. All of the feedback from Beppe, from OAAA, from all of the recent meetings that we've had has been very, very positive. With BroadSign joining with IUTA, I have to say, in all honesty, IUTA's had a little bit of a difficulty over the last couple of years in executing on some of their deployments. And I think the addition of the BroadSign team and the BroadSign focus as far as client satisfaction will enable us to tighten that down and make that a little bit more important. And I think clients are seeing that. They'd like to have a little higher level of reliability that way. At the same time, clients are also excited about the new product offerings that are going to be available, because they understand we may not have it now, but we'll have it. If you will be working on it, and we'll be working on it next year, and we'll be working on evolutions of it 2 years or 3 years from now, and it'll just constantly get better. So I think the feedback is going to be quite positive.
So one of the last times I saw you, you mentioned how you had successfully fought T-Rex, a patent troll, and we're quite pleased with how all that went down. And I'd love to get the story of how you decided, instead of just rolling over to the patent trolls, which is what's typically happened, because it's the path of least resistance, so to speak, you fought.
Well, so what happens, you know, we have the luxury of being a privately funded company, right? And what happens with companies, whether they be public companies or whether they're funded by private equity or something like that, is there's a tendency to make an assessment in a case like this where somebody comes in to essentially extract a tax from an organization. The tendency is to try and negotiate the best deal available and then make them go away. And it's kind of a, I see it in a way, a short-term focus, but the recognition has to be there that if you do that, if you settle a case here or you settle this next case, then basically you're setting a precedent so that anybody else who falls into that category is going to say, oh, well, I'll just file suit against them and they'll settle with me. And if you have that happen throughout an entire industry, then a company can basically make a pretty good living just by threatening to sue people. And that I kind of learned in my prior life when I was with a real estate company, that if you set that pattern, it sets up a bad incentive. So when the T-Rex thing came up, they started filing our suits against our clients. They didn't file suits against us because if they filed suits against us, they wouldn't be able to sue our clients. And basically, they were trying to grab as many people to settle with them as they possibly could. And when I actually heard about it, we flew up to Sweden and I told them, look at guys, this is our core business. We're going to fight this sort of thing. We don't think that your IP is any good. And I'll spend whatever I have to spend to defend the case, but I'm never going to license your software. And I don't think they believe that. They sent out a license agreement. And so we filed the first declaratory judgment action. Then we filed a couple of patent actions with the patent office. During the course of those actions, the T-Rex was able to define their product in a way so that it basically made it look like BroadSign wasn't infringing anymore. And so they were able to get extracted from those patent cases. And then they moved for a dismissal in New York. We were, for a moment, dismissed from New York. But we went back into the case. And the reason we went back into the case is because we were going to keep on going with this thing until everybody understood that if you're going to file one of these cases, you got to expect to fight it all the way through. And I think ultimately what happened is that they realized that, you know, their business model was to sue people and to settle with people on the basis of them not wanting to handle the lawsuits. Well, all of a sudden, when they've got somebody on the other side who's willing to go into court and willing to pay the costs of that suit, they found out that they weren't really willing to pay the costs of the suit anymore. And ultimately, what they decided to do was just release us. And actually, the way that they did it was pretty clever, because by releasing us, there wasn't any way for me to get back into court with them again, although we would have. if we'd had to. At the end of the day, it's not like there was any mutual settlement or anything like that. They just released us. And at that juncture, there's nothing more for me to do. We're getting to the point where pretty much now BroadSign is in the position where we're generally pretty close to prior art for a lot of the stuff in the space. So I don't anticipate we'll see a whole lot more of these things, but there may be some things on the fringes. And by the way, and I told you this the last time we were in a podcast, you know, there may be some times when BroadSign chooses to enforce its intellectual property. It's just that particular business model was one that we felt seemed not to be productive for the industry as a whole.
Did these guys, when you met with them in Sweden, did they present themselves as, yeah, we're a software company, we're doing this stuff, you're infringing? Or were they pretty upfront saying, look, our business model is suing people.
They said they'd been in the business, but they left the business and weren't able to build their networks anymore. And so they were trying to monetize their intellectual property in an alternative form or something.
Right. And are they still out there? Like, are they chasing around other companies?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't know. There was some instance of them trying to raise stuff in Canada at one point in time. Once again, they didn't involve any of our clients, so I didn't come across. But we did indicate that anybody who might be approached by them, we would be more than happy to cooperate with any kind of defense that we could provide support on.
This would not have been an inexpensive exercise.
No, it was expensive. I mean, that's the essence of the whole question, right? Is if you're scared to go to court because of your legal fees, then your incentive is to settle. In this particular instance, my incentive is to use the legal system, you know, as effectively as I can to make sure that the other side recognizes that they have to pay expenses too. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I guess we were prepared to sit at the table a little longer than they were.
Did you get any feedback from competitors or other companies in the industry who may or may not be competitive, who were also involved with T-Rex, who said to you, thank you for going after them in a way that we didn't?
You know, everybody has been very, very supportive. At early times, there was some effort. There was some suggestions that people would try to cooperate. The problem is you can't do cooperative efforts on something like that where it's run by a committee. It just can't be run that way. You have to make quick decisions. You have to make crisp decisions, and you have to have a clear strategy, and you can't really do that thing by a committee. It's the sort of thing where, you know, sometimes there was conversations about, you know, one of the trade groups trying to do something or something like that. You can't do that. There's too many different interests that sit around. It's you really need to have somebody that kind of understands what they're trying to do. And then to the extent that people can cooperate, they can cooperate, but somebody has to kind of drive the bus, as it were.
Right. Last question. You or in the PR that I saw following the acquisitions, there was at least the suggestion that you're not done, that there is other M&A activity, either ongoing or that will happen. So who are you buying?
Well, okay, so I got asked.
You're not going to tell me, are you?
I got asked this question in London too. Look, I can't say we're not going to do anything right away, because if I do, my developers get worried about stuff. But look, the fact of the matter is we got to put these companies together right now. And until we put the companies back together again in a place where we've got a business model where we can flow the kind of consistent profitability that we need to generate in order to build out these products, it's just too complicated to add too many additional factors to it. Now, that being said, does that mean that, you know, we've got a corporate acquisition function or corporate development function that's functioning? Are they still taking calls? You betcha. Are we still looking at things that could potentially come onto the roadmap at some point in time? You betcha. Are we looking at ways to build versus buy? You betcha. But at this juncture, we're more focused on trying to put the existing companies all together and get the machine all put back together again. Does that make sense at all or not?
It does. Yeah, it makes a lot more sense to remove any chaos rather than add more chaos by buying or trying to integrate more than you can at a pace that just won't work.
So that's kind of where we are.
Bert, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You take care of yourself.
I'll try. That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around for more than 2 years. You can click around the archive and find more than 100 conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9 at 16-9.net. There are now more than 6,000 posts in there about this industry. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside beautiful, amazing Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.